How you doing? This is Patrick Irvin, the host of Lessons from the Screen. And unfortunately, I'm caught up doing some things for the nonprofit PAX Inc., our sponsor. So I simply don't have time right now to record a new show, but I am thinking about you. And I understand we missed last week working on it. This will be the last week. Next week, we will be returning. So with that being said, I figured it was a good time to play a replay of this show, Russia, Syria, and the U.S., especially with regards to what's going on right now in the Middle East with Saudi Arabia and what's going on right now between the U.S. and Russia regarding the nuclear treaty that's being pulled out of. So I can't wait to get back to you guys. I hope you enjoy the show and thank you for your support. And I will see you next week when we return with the live episodes of Lessons from the Screen.
Lessons from the screen, what we mean is we go through different documentaries to tell you what they gon' do. Give you our lessons, give them our blessings. If they trash, we tell you there is no second guessing. Knowledge is power, but time is precious. And we're here to keep you from them lessons. So sit back as we groove, giving you the review, so you only spend time on the docs that you need to.
So as the North Korean threat seems to have melted away, the U.S. finds itself increasingly involved in situations that U.S. leaders and officials would love to get out of. In this case, that means the Syrian civil war. Syria, which is located next to Iraq and below Turkey, has been engaged in a civil war since the Arab Spring of 2011, a period of democratic protest that started in Tunisia and moved through the Middle East both violently and non-violently. The civil war, which has displaced millions of people, has largely become a proxy war between Russia and the U.S. and various other powers in the area, with Russia supporting the Syrian government and the U.S. supporting the YPG, or the Kurdish people. This has been the source of growing tensions between the U.S. and Russia, the world's largest military powers, the U.S. ranked number one, Russia ranked number two, and the world's largest nuclear arsenals, Russia ranked number one, U.S. ranked number two. And this past week, pressure grew to another level after the U.S., along with France and the U.K., launched over 100 missiles at various targets in Syria. Welcome to Lessons from the Screen. This is the show where we give you a review of whether or not anything that you can get from any particular digital medium is worth watching. We waste our time, our energy, and our brain power so that you don't have to. You're welcome. And Lessons from the Screen is brought to you by PAX Inc. through the Freedom Train Network. You can find us at www.freedomtrainradio.com or on iTunes, Google Play Music, or Stitcher. And be sure to head to your favorite place as well as the website to leave us a review and comment and let us know what's up. We love interaction. And be sure then to head to www.pactsinc.org. That's PAXINC.org to show some love and support for our sponsors. PAX Inc. is a Black activist and advocacy organization focused on developing the Black community through a shift in culture, education, and economics. And as always, Lessons from the Screen has a frame of reference and perspective that is aligned with that of the Black community. So the things we look at will be looked at with the racial component involved and with some lessons that can be used to improve the community. During this episode of Lessons from the Screen, we will be looking at the Syrian civil war, what started it, how did the superpowers get involved. And we will also be looking at what caused the missile strikes as well as fallout from these missile strikes. And finally, we will be talking about a few lessons Black people can take from these stories. In this episode of Lessons from the Screen, we will be looking at Russia, Syria, and the U.S. In 2010, in Tunisia, North Africa, an Arab revolution took place in order to overthrow the government and replace it with a more democratic one. This movement, within a matter of months, had spread throughout the Arab world, resulting in violence, coups, and civil wars throughout the region. the Iraqi Civil War, the Yemeni Civil War, the Libyan Civil War, and the Syrian Civil War all have their roots in the Arab Revolution that originated in Tunisia. This is often referred to as the Arab Spring. In 2011, fueled by what was happening in the region and discontent with President Bashar al-Assad's government, various different groups emerged to protest and resist the government. The confrontations grew violent when the government violently reacted to the protesters and began cracking down on protests. Now, what's interesting to note here is in the early part of this civil war, soldiers that refused to fire on civilians were executed as well. So that's just, I thought that was interesting. Following that period, however, the country entered a period where the protesters and activists became real rebel forces armed and fighting back. And in 2011, July of 2011, a group of defected officers formed the Free Syrian Army, the FSA, as the first organized oppositional military force with the stated goal of bringing the Assad government down. But they weren't the only group, as several other groups also developed and began successfully attacking and counterattacking government forces in response to government activity, such as crackdowns on protests. And in April of 2012, the UN brokered a regional ceasefire to try to proceed to a place of peace. However, on 25 May 2012, the Halua massacre occurred, during which over 100 people, 49 of which were children, were killed, summarily executed. This was attributed to pro-government factions by the UN. However, the Syrian government said that it was Al-Qaeda and that they threatened the civilians not to speak of such. The ceasefire collapsed and the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, began nationwide attacks on the government. After fighting, a rebel group took control of an airbase in January of 2013, and other rebel forces, later identified as ISIS or ISIL, captured the city of Raqqa in March of 2013, making it the first provincial capital lost by the Assad government. In April 2013, the government was finally able to regroup, stop the rebel offensives, and go on the offense itself. After recapturing some of its lost territory, the situation became a stalemate. And in August of 2013, a chemical attack took place in Damascus, leading to thousands of casualties, and was followed by an attack by government forces. This is when the UN again got involved, as chemical warfare is in violation of war agreements. The war has largely continued along these lines, with the Syrian government slowly taking the country back while being accused of using chemical warfare to weaken rebel forces and civilian threats. So you might be asking, yeah, all that's well and good, but how does the United States come into play? So in 2011, at the start of all of this, President Obama formally called on Assad to step down for the sake of the Syrian people and issued sanctions against the government meant to weaken the government's ability to fight back and sustain itself. And in 2012, President Obama made his famous, or infamous, depending on your political leanings, red line remark, where he stated that chemical warfare was a red line for which his administration would have to change its calculations on how it would take care of the situation in Syria. Many took that to mean that if chemical weapons were used, the U.S. would intervene militarily. And in 2013, President Obama started to feel political pressure increase as chemical warfare was being used. This escalated in 2013 when 1,500 civilians were killed by chemicals attacks. The Syrian government was charged with responsibility for that attack. And later, in 2013, Obama asked Congress to approve strikes. However, the proposal did not receive the support it needed to pass. And it should be noted that then civilian Donald Trump used his Twitter to warn against involving the U.S. in Syria. It should also be noted that many polls showed that Americans did not agree with the use of force in Syria. Even later, though, in 2013, U.S. and Russia, Assad's ally, reached an agreement to remove or destroy serious chemical weapons by mid-2014. And in June of 2014, the last of the serious declared chemical weapons have been successfully removed from the country. However, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, did say that they could not say for sure that it was the last of the chemical weapons. And I'll say that again. The last of Syria's declared weapons have been successfully removed from the country. Later, in 2014, U.S. Congress approved an Obama plan to arm and train rebels in Syria to fight the Islamic State in the region, and the U.S. carried out airstrikes against Syria with the help of an international coalition. In early 2015, the YPG, or the People's Protection Units, a Kurdish group aligned with democracy, began to receive air and ground support from the U.S. The YPG, also with the aid of U.S. and others, captured the city of Raqqa from other rebel forces viewed by the U.S. as a terrorist organization known as ISIS. At the U.S.'s urging, the YPG created a branch called the SDF, that included not only Kurdish forces, but democratic forces from all over the globe that wanted to assist with the YPG's mission. And the SDF stands for Syrian Democratic Forces. Now, in August of 2016, the Syrian government was accused of carrying out toxic chlorine gas attacks in 2014 and 2015 by the OPCW. And in April of 2017, the U.S. launched 59 Tomahawk missiles into the country following yet another chemical attack. In July of 2017, the Trump administration stopped equipping and training rebel forces. And in November of 2017, the U.S. government announced that it would maintain a presence in northern Syria, largely Kurdish areas controlled by the SDF or the YPG, to counter Iran's influence and oust President Assad. So, to sum that up, the U.S. has been involved since the beginning and has actively been taking steps to overthrow the government. But what about Russia? Well, Russia has been an ally of Syria since 1956, back when it was the Soviet Union. And it has trained and supplied the Syrian government's forces, as well as kept the Syrian government afloat economically. It has been claimed by some U.S. officials that Russia's presence in Syria is part of the reason why the government did not want to enforce President Obama's red line. And while in 2012, Russian President Vladimir Putin said that Russia did not support any side of the conflict, in 2013, Russia stepped up its military support for the Syrian government by supplying armored vehicles, electronic warfare systems, radars, spare parts, and various other weapons, including guided bombs, to the Syrian government. In 2015, Russia started direct military intervention, including airstrikes against rebel forces and anyone else that was a declared enemy of the Syrian government. And in 2015, the U.S. and Russia signed a secret memorandum of understanding to avoid air incidents over Syria. So that's the history, and it's extremely simplified. And if you really want to say that you thoroughly understand all of that, you really need to do a lot more research, because I had to leave a lot of stuff out to condense all of the last 7 years since 2011 of what's going on in Syria down into 10 minutes. So we're going to move forward with some of the modern events that are happening. Now, the Syrian civil war has largely been called the start of the next great world war. It's been called a powder keg. People have been talking about it for a while because all of the major players are involved in Syria in some way, shape, form, or fashion. The United States, China, Russia, all of the European Union. You know, these guys, they're all in there, as well as all of the Middle Eastern or the Arab world for the most part. They're all involved in this Syrian civil war, supporting a rebel group here or supporting the Assad government. So this past Saturday, the U.S., along with France and Britain, decided to launch missiles into Syria as a response to yet another chemical attack, of which the United States says there have been more than 50, the target being a believed chemical weapons facility. And of course, Russia denounced the attack in the strongest terms possible. And as if this weren't bad enough, not only do we have the United States and Russia beefing with each other, whether you want to believe it or not, this was followed up by the ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, making statements about new sanctions against Russia, which was something that got her in hot water with President Donald Trump, who had decided against it, and nobody apparently told Nikki Haley, which allowed for an interesting exchange of back and forth between the White House and Nikki Haley. Now, this is interesting because, again, not only is the United States beefing with other outside players, but the United States is also openly and publicly beefing with itself. So this becomes even more interesting when you look at this and the state of affairs that we're going through right now. Again, though, this is an extremely interesting and nuanced set of events going back almost 10 years. And while the most recent developments are extremely important and significant, they are being drowned out by all of the other daily occurrences happening with this White House. But what can we learn from this? Now, as always, and with all the topics that we cover, there are a multitude, a plethora of lessons that can be learned from each one of these topics. So I do want to harp on the fact that we only pick out the ones that we feel are significant to us. And we don't even hit on all of those because there's a long list of significant, important lessons to be learned from all of these shows. So I want to state that here because, again, we're condensing the last 10 years of military, economic, and political history into a 20-minute lesson or a 25-minute podcast, and then giving you some of the lessons. So I want to stress that out, how important it is for people to go, for you to go and dig into this a little bit more and pull out some of those other lessons, or even engage with me on the website and let me know some of your thoughts so that we can go back and forth on that. But in any case, I think one of the things that this goes, and this goes back to the discussion we have about sovereignty. The Syrian government believes it is defending its sovereignty by attacking rebel groups. The U.S. and other UN nations no longer recognize the sovereignty of the Assad regime and now have moved to overthrow their government, which, if it were not for the Russians supporting the Syrian government, would have happened. Also to mention here that China is also a supporter of the Syrian government, the Assad regime, while they have not, to what I could find, done anything on the level of what Russia has done. They have announced in various instances their support of the Assad regime, the Syrian government. So if you go back to my show on Catalonia, I spent a good deal of time talking about sovereignty, and I'm going to keep harping on that every time it comes up because sovereignty is one of those issues that we talk about, but I'm not entirely sure we've thought through thoroughly, or if we have, I'm not entirely sure we understand completely what is going on when we start throwing around the word sovereignty. I think this also further reveals the deep political divide present in America. Things that were bad for Obama, such as missile strikes and military intervention, are good for Trump. And we don't really even need more examples of that. But what is interesting is, with the polarization of the American society on a political level, we're also seeing a polarization of the Black community in many respects. We're becoming even more divisive, and that's not inherently a problem because I do believe that there is strength in diversity of thought. The problem is that we are becoming so polarized and so against opposite forms of thought that it's becoming damn near impossible for a group of us to get together and work together. And that divide is starting to manifest itself along political lines in ways that I haven't seen before, even looking through the books and whatnot, just haven't seen before. So that is something that we need to be aware of. Historically, we need to be aware of what's going on because, again, when you go back to the Cold War, when the United States was involved in a Cold War, a series of proxy wars and escalated tensions with the Soviet Union, you had what I just said, proxy wars, exactly what the Syrian war has to an extent become, where you have two larger powers fighting each other through the manipulation of lesser powers. So you have this government on this side supporting this regime, this government on this side supporting this regime. And even though the two governments, the two larger superpowers, are not directly combating each other, they're offering strategy, they're offering tactics, they're offering technical support, they're offering supplies and munitions, they're offering expertise to their factions in order to support them in the war, hoping to beat the other side. We really saw this when democracy was at war with communism in Vietnam, so or in Korea. So this is what we're dealing with. And I think that is important because it's something that should be paid attention to, because we're seeing this again in Syria right now. Now, I think there are two lessons for black people directly that have to be mentioned. One of which is that we like to talk about how we're going to overthrow this and how we can beat that and how we can do this. And I really think that those of us in the pro-black community, those of us in the quote-unquote conscious community, the quote-unquote black empowerment community, need to do a better job of pushing back against the militant sects. And when I say militant, I don't mean it in terms of what the white people say. I mean in terms of those people that advocate for white people to go, or for black people to go to war with white people. We need to be firmer and united in our pushback against that narrative, because here again you see yet another example, and we saw this in Korea as well as in other places, another example of how isolation destroys. All of the rebel groups that did not find a major sponsor have been wiped out. The only groups left are the groups that are being propped up and supported by a major force in the area or by a superpower such as Russia or the United States. So without allies, your cause is doomed when it has to compete against a larger force. Building in isolation is entirely possible. It is entirely possible for us to build up a strong and vibrant economic, social, and cultural community. It is entirely viable. And it is entirely viable for us to build up strong self-defense mechanisms within that community. But the moment you start competing with or warring with, and when I say competing, I mean competing in all senses of the word. I also mean competing in terms of economic competitions, competing in terms of business situations, because business is nothing more than economic warfare. When you start competing or warring with a larger, more powerful, more resourceful organization, and you don't have any support or any backing, it is a recipe for a disaster. You are building your own grave. And a lot of people want to say, well, in the Olympics, you have smaller countries beating larger countries all the time. And that's a form of competing. True. But if you look at where a large portion of those world-class athletes train, they're mostly training in larger countries with more resources, or they're training with coaches that have acquired their expertise from larger countries with resources. So it's still a partnership. And finally, one final point, and I'm going to drive this home. Millions of people have been displaced by this war. 170,000 estimated, more than 170,000 have died since the war started. More than 5 million have fled the country, and more than 6 million have been displaced within the country. That means that more than 10 million people in total have had their lives drastically upended. Drastically upended by the start of this war. And those that were released last April, after first airstrike, war chemical weapons in the area, we saw that, as we all know happens, there was a bump in his progress. We know what happens. No need to get into this. But what's more disturbing is that everything that that's happened to the Syrian people, that these people have been through, what's more disturbing is that despite the fact that more than 10 million people have been displaced and 500,000 people killed only 55% of white people agree that they should be allowed into the country. And if they feel that way about people that they don't have a negative history with, but do have negative stereotypes of, how do we think they feel about us and our humanity when they have both a negative history and a negative stereotype and a belief that they understand who we are in their negativity towards us? If they won't allow other people into the nation to save their lives and protect their humanity, why would they give up their power to give us access to a better life? And this is not just a tiny fraction. This is 40% that actively oppose letting in refugees. Now, I understand, and I will retract my earlier statement, because they do have a negative stereotype of, they do have a negative history with Arab people, with Muslim people, going all the way back to the old cartoons of the day. The three bad guys: Native Americans, Arab Muslims, and Africans. Those were the three bad guys in all of the cartoons. So I do recognize that. But the fact still stands that if they won't allow them in to save their very lives, why would they give up their power, their access, and all of the other advantages they have when our lives aren't even on the line, in their opinion? In their opinion. So, and this is also with over 50% of voting whites voting for Donald Trump, who has been fighting, actively fighting, to keep everybody out. In 7 years, no one has stepped in to save these people. And a lot of them are saying that when they get to other countries, they're mistreated or they're treated as second-class citizens. So, with knowing this, why do we keep behaving as if someone is going to step in and save us? As if a light switch is just going to flip on and all of a sudden they're going to magically understand our situation and what they've done to us and take steps to rectify the situation. It is not going to happen. There is a reason why it has not happened. And we need to acknowledge that. At some point, we have got to take ownership of our problems, our own problems, and start working to fix them ourselves. We can do it. We simply have to want.
Lessons from the screen, what we mean is we go through different documentaries to tell you what they gon' do. Give you our lessons, give them our blessings. If they trash, we tell you there is no second guessing. Knowledge is power, but time is precious, and we're here to keep you from them lessons. So sit back as we groove, giving you the review, so you only spend time on the docs that you need to.